You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, extreme heat now kills more Americans than hurricanes, floods, and tornadoes. You'll hear how cities, states, and the federal government are responding to reduce the number of lives lost to heat. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, many pet owners have seen their dog or cat asleep on the couch or the ground and watched them kick their legs or fidget in their sleep. It looks like our pets are dreaming. They can't tell us what they were dreaming about, but it seems like they're experiencing something imaginary while asleep. So if our pets can dream, does that mean all animals can dream? If animals can dream, what does that tell us about how their minds work? In his new book, our next guest explores the neurological and philosophical sides of animals, their brains, and what happens when they sleep. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that animals dream? Have you ever seen one of your pets and you thought maybe it was having a dream? What do you think they dream about? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Peña Guzman is an associate professor of humanities at San Francisco State University. His new book is called When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Before we get into some of the science and philosophy behind whether animals dream, you're asking the question for a couple reasons. A, it's super interesting. B, the answer to these questions you write will influence how we treat the rest of the animals that we share this planet with. Can you talk about what you're hoping comes out of that?
Yeah, this is something that I talk in the book, especially towards the end, that for a long time we have known that what we know about the minds of other animals ends up having repercussions that go far beyond simply that curiosity that we might have about what goes on in their minds, either when they're awake or when they're asleep. There are also legal, political, and moral implications. And in the book, I talk about specifically the connection between the minds of other animals, their consciousness, and then the moral obligations that we might have toward them once we realize that they are indeed conscious, that they are sentient beings who are agents in the world.
You review the science behind animals and sleep and dreaming. There's not a ton of it in some ways, and there was a big switch in the 19th century, in the 1800s. A lot of people who did research said, of course, yeah, animals dream. And then there was a turn against that idea. What led to that?
Yeah, if you look at the writings of very famous 19th century naturalists, I mean, here we're talking about people like Charles Darwin, what you find is that most of them were very open to the idea that dreaming is a parallel that we find between human and non-human animals. If you look at animals like dogs and cats, but even at more distant creatures, distant from us from an evolutionary perspective, that is, you find these recreations or reconstructions of the world in the middle of the sleep cycle. And so in the 19th century, this was not a radical idea. It was not taboo. In fact, it was thought to be a pretty natural consequence of the, at that time, rising evolutionary framework. So once you accept that, of course, all the diversity of animal forms that we observe in nature is the result of evolution, then of course you expect to see a lot of continuity at the level of behavioral capacities, mental capacities, and so on. And so there's a lot of writing about animals having things like dreams, animals having concepts, animals having emotions. And unfortunately, all of this changes in the early 20th century. And the story that I tell in the book places psychology as a new science at the end of the 19th century front and center, because in the early 20th century, psychology did somewhat of a shift, or it pivoted away from a certain way of doing psychology to a new way of doing psychology. And this is what is known as behaviorism. Behaviorism, in very simple terms, is a style of thinking in psychology that basically says, look, we are not going to worry about mental phenomena. We're only going to focus on behavior. Why? Well, because behavior obviously is much more easily controlled. It is much more easily elicited. And it is measurable in a way that purely mental events are not. So, for instance, you can measure how far a dog walks. You can measure how many times they wag their tail. But you cannot really measure things like their thoughts, their emotions, and obviously their dreams. And so for a long time, for most of the first half of the 20th century, which is what I call the silent century in the book, there is this deafening silence about the minds of other animals. And I think this was a major mistake in the history of science. And thankfully, in the last few decades, this has been changing. I would say it's been changing now for about 3, 4, maybe even 5 decades. But the legacy of behaviorism is still very much with us. And it's something that we still have to actively resist in the natural sciences and especially in the animal sciences.
We're talking to David Peña Guzman. His new book is called When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever watched your pet sleeping and thought, hey, I think they're having a dream now based on their behavior? 800-642-1234. I want to check out a couple of the studies you share in the book. Now we have brain imaging technology. You share the story of, I think it was a bird. It was a kind of finch that maybe was doing some musical rehearsals in its sleep. Can you share that story?
Yeah, that's right. These are zebra finches, which are birds native to Australia. And one of the things that we know about these birds is that they sing a song and their song is not innate. In other words, it's not as if a little zebra finch, you know, comes out of the egg already having that, all the information for that song somehow preloaded into their brain or their nervous system. It's not in the genes from the moment of birth. And so that means that every single zebra finch has a challenge, which is how am I going to memorize this really complicated melody that I need in order to be a zebra finch? And we know that they have to practice because they learn it from their parents and their siblings, and they usually have to practice. So they listen to others singing the song, and then they set to trying to internalize it on their own. So they practice during the day. And I found research showing that at night, they also practice their song. And when I say at night, I don't just mean when the sun goes down. I mean when the zebra finches fall asleep. And so if you look at the zebra finch brain in the middle of the sleep cycle, especially as these animals are transitioning into what is known as REM sleep, which is typically when animals have dreams, statistically speaking, the areas of the brain that start lighting up are precisely the same that light up during the waking state when these animals are rehearsing their song. And so we know that these animals have these auditory, magnificent, beautiful dreams. And it might be that their dreams are even playing a central function of memory consolidation, whereby by dreaming about their song, these animals are memorizing the song that they need in order to succeed and flourish as finches during the day.
That's just one of the examples you give in the book of different species that seem to be having some kind of dreams. But it brings up an important point. There, a finch's dream might be very auditory. A dog's dream might be very smell-oriented. What we think of as dreaming might not apply. It might look very different, feel very different to a different animal having those dreams.
That's correct. And one important point, one takeaway from my research is that we need to be extremely careful about being anthropocentric, which is a bit of a mouthful. it just comes from the root anthropos, a Greek term meaning human, and centric. And so we need to not center humans in our thinking about and in our definition of certain phenomena such as dreams. And so, of course, in the case of humans, the vast majority of human dreams tend to be visual because we are, by large, a visual species. But when you shift the focus away from humans to other animals, then you have to be open to the fact that those dreams will follow the sensory capacities of those animals. rather than the expectations that we might project based on our particular case, right? A dog is never going to dream a human dream. A zebra finch is not going to dream a dog dream either. And so paying attention to those differences is really important, but it also adds a major level of difficulty for us thinking about the dreams of other animals, especially when they are, when they become less and less similar to ours.
We're talking to philosophy professor David Peña Guzman about his new book, When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered examples where you've seen an animal, maybe your pet, and you think it's having a dream, probably based on what it's doing while it's sleeping? Have you ever thought about what it means for an animal to dream or have imagination? What questions do you have about animal consciousness? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with David Peña Guzman, philosophy professor at San Francisco State University, author of the book When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think animals dream? Do you think your pet does? What questions do you have about animal dreams and animal consciousness? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Shaquan is with us in Beloit. Shaquan, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
It's so crazy because, like, literally yesterday I was looking up the subject, and it's so intriguing. That's why I love NPR. But basically, it was like it extends to all species, even insects and such, but they kind of, like, eliminate it because they correlated with REM sleep. But it's more in, like, their baby phase, as they put it. Like, all species dream in their baby phase more. But I'm not sure. I wonder if that did extend to insects and stuff as well.
Interesting question. And I just saw on NPR.org, actually, something about spiders maybe having a REM, or rapid eye movement cycle. How about next door in the insect world, David? Do we know anything about what's going on there?
Yeah, we do know some things. I think it was around 2014, 2015, that some research started coming out about honeybees. Showing that they show a lot of signs of what we would call dreaming. Of course, this becomes extremely thought-provoking because insects have historically suffered from the terrible fate of being seen as the simplest of animals, at least like the large-scale animals that we interact with on a daily basis. So often people assume that because they have so-called simple nervous systems, that they couldn't possibly perform certain mental or cognitive operations that we deem impressive, like dreaming. And yet the research suggests that we might have to extend it to insects and also to arthropods like spiders. This research on jumping spiders that you just mentioned just came out about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. I mean, my book came out in July, in the summer, so it's in many ways hot off the press. And already there is new research that I didn't have at the time that I was writing it. So brand new research showing that jumping spiders, which are a particularly visual kind of spider that relies on vision much more than sensation, than sensing vibrations on the ground, that when they fall asleep, they also show, they display the same kind of REM movements, rapid eye movements, that in human beings, since the 1950s, we have treated as very clear indicators of dreaming. So, you know, the small critters of the world are now claiming their place in the community of dreamers, and I think that's very exciting.
Shaquan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. David, you write that, you know, whether we're talking about zebra finches or rats showing signs that they're thinking about moving around in mazes while they sleep, some of the researchers who are doing this say, yeah, this is just, you know, sort of a video replay. They're just reenacting the stuff that they did in their lives. There's no creative force going on here. No imagination, no alternate reality going on in here. You don't buy that, though.
I don't. And I think this is maybe a vestige of what I mentioned earlier as the legacy of behaviorism, because I think a lot of scientists are still a little bit suspicious about the mental capacities of other animals. And so sometimes they just find it easier in the moment to say, I don't know that I want to call this, let's say, dreaming or thinking or emotion or imagination in the case of a non-human animal, because then that does introduce the burden and the challenge of trying to figure out what that means in the case of a non-human, which is not easy. I mean, I specialize in animal philosophy and animal science, and yes, it's fascinating, but it's also very tricky because you have to walk some uneven terrains sometimes. And so I disagree with people who believe that animals don't dream, or that if they have some experiences, then they must be so inferior to ours that they don't deserve the name dreaming. And I think the evidence actually is on my side in this debate. I think by now the preponderance of the evidence indicates that animals do dream. And that includes not only mammals, but it includes also birds. It includes, I just mentioned insects and arthropods. In the book, I also talk about cephalopods like octopuses, which are just so distant from us from an evolutionary point of view that it raises questions about the origin of dreaming. How far back in the history of life do we have to go to find, you know, the first dream or the first dreamer? And it just boggles the mind in many ways.
Talking to David Peña Guzmán, author of the new book, When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. David, what to you is the best study, the best research you've seen that's a selling point to make the case that, yes, in fact, animals are dreaming in a meaningful way, not just arbitrarily replaying the events of the day?
Well, I think we live in a culture where neuroscience has a lot of cultural capital. I think in the last 40 years or so, it really has become the lingua franca of science, especially when it comes to animals and behavior. And so that's why I focus on a lot of neuroscientific research, looking at brain activity patterns of neural activation in many animals. I look primarily at rodents and other mammals, just because we have a lot more research about them. But I also talk about patterns of neural activation in other species like birds and also fish. There's been some interesting research on brainwave activity during REM sleep in certain species of fish. And so I think the neuroscience is extremely persuasive when it comes to establishing these parallels between waking experience and the sleep state or the dream state. But I also think that we need to be open to the behavioral evidence, to the things that we do observe in those animals that we share our life with. I don't think it's a major jump or an unreasonable jump or a leap of faith for somebody to look at a sleeping dog or at a sleeping cat who is running and vocalizing and fighting with imaginary enemies in the middle of sleep and to say, you know what? I think this is probably a dream. And unfortunately, that's the kind of conclusion that a lot of scientists want to resist, again, for the reasons that I talked about a little bit earlier.
Now, consciousness is one of the trickiest ideas in philosophy and neuroscience, psychology for that matter. But can you connect the dots? If we accept the argument that, yeah, animals are dreaming, what does that tell us about our search for consciousness among our fellow animals?
Yeah, I once was told by an expert that if you ask 10 people who specialize in consciousness to define consciousness, you'll get about 15 different definitions. And in some ways, the book that I wrote is entirely about this question. It is about dreaming. Of course, that's the subject of the book, but it is because I see dreaming as intricately connected to questions of sentience, to questions of consciousness, to questions of agency, and what in the book I call subjectivity. So I want to think about the subjectivity of animals by using their dreams as this entry point into their lived world. And so one way to make the connection explicit here between dreaming and consciousness is through three intermediary categories. And these are the three categories that, for example, organize my analysis in the central and most important chapter of the book, which is chapter 2. And those three categories are subjectivity, affect or emotion, and finally, metacognition. So what I do in the book is I look at research on the philosophy of dreaming and the science of dreaming. Of course, here focusing in the case of humans, just how we have thought about the significance of dreams in the course of, you know, over the last couple of millennia in philosophy and science. And I argue that there are some fundamental links that we already accept between dreaming and being consciously aware of the world, between having dreams and having emotions, and between having dreams, or rather some kinds of dreams, this is a more limited claim, and being metacognitive agents. And so in the book, what I do is I ask the question in reverse from the point of view of animals. So if we already recognize this connection between dreams and all these categories, given the fact that we now have it on pretty good authority, scientific and philosophical, that non-human animals also dream, does that mean that other animals also have these three different types of consciousness? Again, which I call subjective consciousness, affective consciousness, and metacognitive consciousness.
And David, that's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's David Peña Guzman, Associate Professor of Humanities at San Francisco State University. He was with us today sharing his new book, When Animals Dream, The Hidden World of Animal Consciousness. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, big national newspapers are doing big business while local papers are seeing buyouts, layoffs, and even shutdowns. What does that mean for the news we get in our communities? We'll take a look at the future of local news. Plus, we'll check out two efforts to make recreation accessible here in Wisconsin. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Music has served as a form of political and social expression in the U.S. going back to the Revolutionary War and beyond. When we think of protest music, we might jump to the Vietnam War era of the 1960s and 70s, like Fortunate Son by Creedence Clearwater Revival. But artists throughout the 20th century and on to today continue to write songs that offer commentary on pressing issues. What's changed over the years? Is the golden age of the protest song over, or have things just changed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. When I say protest music, what does that mean to you? What do you think of? What era do you think of? What performer or song? Is there a song or artist from a particular time that stays with you? Do you notice when music has a political or social message behind it? Do you want music to have political or social messages behind it, or do you want music to get away from those things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison who teaches about music and culture. He's also a voter for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Alexander, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's nice to be back.
Well, I imagine protest music has been around since there was music, but when did it really get mainstream popularity in the U.S.? When, you know, it wasn't just the people, you know, singing it, but it became part of pop culture?
Well, that's a great question. Of course, there has been, as you noted, music about protest and music about politics as long as we have had music. If you think about it, songs about war are certainly songs that are political, and those are among the oldest songs we have in human culture. So the idea of having political music has always existed, and it has always existed in the United States. In every single era, we have songs that are about the political conditions that we are in, songs of protest as well. In the modern recorded era, you can find songs about the Depression, you can find songs about World War II. There's really no era in which there isn't music about politics and protest, whether it's about the economy and poverty, whether it's about war, whether it's about the changes in society, whether it's about race relations or gender. They have always been there. But in the modern era that really starts with the birth of rhythm and blues and rock and roll, it is the 60s, the mid-60s into the early 70s, that is the first period that we really look at a moment when there is a kind of merging of protest music and popular music, popular hits that are consistently songs about what is going on in American society in explicit ways. So that's really the moment when it starts in that particular era. And it is also, you know, in part a way in which we periodize that, because that is the moment that many of us first remember that popular political music emerging.
Is there a significant difference between, you know, a song with political lyrics and songs that people might sing at a protest? You know, is there something different with the communal experience of singing We Shall Overcome at a civil rights rally, or This Land Is Our Land, or whatever, versus, you know, a song that you kind of passively listen to?
Well, obviously, it can be a different experience. If you are listening to the song by yourself in isolation, or if you're driving in your car, it may have you thinking about politics. It may have you contemplating political action in some form or another, but you're by yourself. And so the relationship is between your own thoughts and the art itself. That is part of the call and response, the longstanding tradition in which music helps to form community and creates a kind of dialogue between the art and individuals. But that becomes much more straightforward and explicit when it happens in a communal setting. So if people are singing the music together at a march, at a protest, in a performance, then there is a kind of shared sense of identity and a shared sense of purpose that comes out of singing that song and relating it to the situation that you are in.
Let's dive into songs related to civil rights now. You sent us some suggestions for influential or important protest-related songs. People Get Ready by Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions from 1965, kind of a movement anthem. Here's a listen.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
Those of us listening with headphones getting a stereo there back and forth. Alexander, why did songs like that one, People Get Ready, resonate well with people in the fight for civil rights?
So the fight for civil rights was a longstanding one for African Americans. Of course, as long as African Americans have been on this continent, they have struggled to gain civil rights and to have equal opportunity to be both citizens and to be politically active in American society. So it has always been part of the African-American struggle. And that struggle has been at times very deeply tied to the church. The church was a location where people could gather, where African-Americans could gather, where they could talk about the struggles that they were experiencing, where they could escape from those struggles and find refuge and community and joy. And so the sounds of gospel music have long been a sound that African-Americans have used as a way to express their view of the world, including through politics. Now, that has often been metaphorical through gospel music, and it's one of the reasons why African-Americans could get away with singing those songs, because they were metaphorical as opposed to being explicit. As we get into the era of rhythm and blues and soul, what we see are artists who are deeply grounded in the gospel tradition and in the gospel impulse, the idea of finding redemption or finding a better place both in this world and beyond, and they translate it into secular music. So as they do that, they take many of the sounds of community, of redemption, of gathering together to make progress, and they translate them from a purely religious setting into one that is more or less secular. And that's what a song like People Get Ready by Curtis Mayfield does. Curtis Mayfield, who was from Chicago, was deeply connected to church music, and then took that lesson and those experiences and brought them into the pop music that he was creating. So a song like People Get Ready, it's about the train to Jordan. It is not just literally about that, but it is also, even more importantly, metaphorically, about the idea of finding a way for people to get to the promised land, to get to the place that they want to be, where they can find happiness, where they can find freedom. And that's really the purpose of the song.
We are talking about the history of protest music in the United States with Alexander Shashko, who teaches about music and culture at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, maybe your favorite songs, artists, memories of protest music at 800-642-1234. Brian joins us now in Green Bay. Brian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I wanted to bring up a band that is alternative rock or maybe punk rock in its origin that started in, I believe, the 90s, known as Rage Against the Machine. And they were a political band that decided to do the opposite of the Gospels, actually. Instead of being metaphorical, they were very direct in their message. And singer, songwriter, and activist lead singer, the indefatigable Zach De La Rocha, and the guitarist, Mr. Tom Morello, who is insurmountable in his talents, both have continued to create music and are continuing to be on tour given the time and age that we live in, and continue to spread a political message that is a bit more in your face. And the band name being Raging as the Machine seems to speak for itself, in my opinion, as to their message and their purpose as a band.
Brian, thanks for the call. Alexander.
Well, you're not going to hear me disagree with you about the importance of Rage Against the Machine. I actually did vote for them when they were a nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. They did not get in. I think it's probably a matter of time before they do. But in any event, I absolutely agree about Rage Against the Machine being a really important band in the history of both rock music and also the history of protest music. Tom Morello is an incredibly innovative guitarist, and the group really took on the mantle of protest bands that had come before them, both from the world of rock and punk in particular, but also from hip hop. And part of what makes Rage Against the Machine such a powerful group is that they're really probably the most both musically influential and politically active of all of the bands that are kind of rap rock hybrid groups, the groups that draw from both the rock tradition and the hip hop tradition. And so what you hear when you listen to Rage Against the Machine is a group that is drawing on groups from the MC5 to the Clash on the rock side of things, but also drawing from groups like Public Enemy on the hip hop side of things. And in the process, bringing together a kind of fusion of those two worlds that is also meant to represent a way of bridging those two worlds and looking for common cause, because it's often the case both with musical genres and with protest that they often can't hear one another or can't work with one another because they're so devoted to the particular issues that they're dealing with. And part of what Rage Against the Machine was trying to accomplish, both symbolically through their sound and explicitly through their lyrics, was to bring those two worlds together.
Brian, thanks for the call. I'm sorry, we didn't pull any Rage Against the Machine, but in these more in-your-face style, Alexander, you just mentioned Public Enemy. Here's their 1988 Fight the Power. Gotta give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need. Hey, our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Alexander, the hip-hop thread there, obviously a very different sound than the more mellow Curtis Mayfield we heard earlier.
Absolutely, a different sound. Although, certainly there was a point later when Curtis Mayfield was a lot closer to Public Enemy than he was with People Get Ready. But yeah, that is the sound of frustration and of anger. But above all, it's really a sound that is just trying to get people's attention. For many African Americans, especially younger generations of African Americans in the 1980s, they felt that their voices were not being heard in the political discourse of the day, that much of the dialogue about race relations was, in their view, a kind of tired discussion of whether or not the civil rights movement had fully succeeded, about whether or not race relations was something that had been somehow resolved in the 1960s, and that there really wasn't a lot more to talk about. And what a group like Public Enemy was trying to accomplish was to be heard through all of that static, and to be heard when there was a lot of silence about the experience that young African Americans and young African American men in particular were experiencing and dealing with. And so they created both lyrics that were purposefully confrontational and more importantly, in my opinion, a sound that was purposely confrontational, that they wanted the sound of sirens. They wanted the sound of the city. They wanted a chaotic kind of sound that would grab you by the lapels and force you to pay attention to them so that you couldn't turn away from the things that they wanted to say. And in that sense, they really took political hip hop to a different level. It had already existed. Grandmaster Flash's and the Furious Five's The Message, of course, was the first big political hip hop song. And there were groups like Boogie Down Production. But Public Enemy really take it to an entirely different level. They make politics the centerpiece of the music that they're creating and thus create an opening for hip hop artists to be more politically engaged through their music.
We're talking about the history and evolution of protest music in the U.S. with UW-Madison lecturer Alexander Shashko. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your favorites, your memories about protest music. 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. That's Bruce Springsteen's 1984 hit, Born in the USA, his response to the end of the Vietnam War and how veterans were treated when they returned home. We continue our talk about protest and political music, how it's changed across the decades. Alexander Shashko is with us, lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, who teaches about music and culture. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, well, it goes back. The tried and true Buffalo Springfield 1966, for what it's worth. Everybody's right, but everybody's wrong. And that goes with every battle, every outcry, every protest we've ever had, and we're still having with an adulterated Supreme Court going against women's reproductive rights. It's right there. And then my second is Richie Havens, Freedom. That is just a constant. He sang his heart out at Woodstock and made that song. And if it's not everybody's anthem, it should be.
Gail, thanks for the call. And that was interesting, Alexander. She talked about how the same song, in this case, For What It's Worth, can apply to a lot of different situations. A lasting protest song may fit a lot of different circumstances.
Absolutely. And that is a song that has survived through the years, that any time there has been a moment of political turmoil, especially regarding war, For What It's Worth has emerged again. It is a song that not only got played again when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan began, but it was covered artists at that time and sampled. And in fact, Stephen Stills is actually on a Public Enemy song in which they sample For What It's Worth, a song called He Got Game. And so that tradition of taking those old songs and reimagining them in a new era has lived on to this day. It's certainly lived on into the era of hip hop. And that has happened for a long time. If you think about what artists like Richie Havens were doing during the folk revival, much of what they were doing was to draw from political folk music from an earlier era, from the 1920s or 30s or 40s, and then to both, you know, play those songs again in the context of a new time and draw off of those musical traditions to create new songs to fit the times that they are in. So both of those artists and those songs that they performed really represent a link in the chain of tradition, both past and into our present day, in which those songs live on as anthems for a kind of protest that people want to engage in.
Thanks for that call, Gail. We'll go to Tom now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. There was a song that was sung a lot during the Vietnam War era. It was written by a folk singer, Native American woman, Buffy St. Marie, and it was covered by a British folk singer Donovan called The Universal Soldier. Spoke about how patriots of any country fight for love of their own country.
Tom, thanks for the call. Alexander?
Yeah, that is absolutely a song that sort of creates this complex scenario in which it is engaging in both the questions of the importance of war, but also the importance of country and identity and who's responsible for fighting. Is a soldier someone who is responsible for making the choices about whether they fight or whether they are, or are they someone who is, you know, being asked to do their part for the community within which they live? You know, ultimately what it says is that everyone needs to be responsible for their own actions and everyone needs to make their own choices. And of course, in the context of the Vietnam War, that was a very, very heated subject because between the draft and those who were choosing to fight, there were a lot of hard individual choices between a sense of duty, a sense of patriotism to country, and then a sense of patriotism to ideas, or a sense of justice and in terms of fighting war and of being someone who's willing to kill in order to win that war. And so that those kind of complicated questions are always part of any kind of protest music tradition, especially when it comes to war. There's a whole subgenre of music, and it's really not a subgenre, it's its own genre, that are songs about the experience of the soldiers themselves. And Fortunate Son, which you played earlier, is a prime example of that. That is a song that is not taking a position so strongly on the import or on the on whether or not the Vietnam War should be fought, but rather on who is fighting it and what the consequences are for both those who fight it and those who do not. So that question about individual responsibility and the choices that we make is one that we often hear when it comes to political music, and especially political music about war.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to take our last few minutes, Alexander, to look at political music today. I think it's easy to turn and say, okay, yeah, the 60s, early 70s, that was the golden age, not so much anymore. You don't buy that, though.
I do not. There is lots of political music. Now, there are a few reasons why that may not seem as apparent as it has in the past. One is that there's just so much music today that there's more of everything, including protest music. It's also the case that in the internet age and in the world of streaming that we're in, and in a world of instantaneous and mass amounts of information, a protest song doesn't quite have the same kind of time to gather an audience and to become anthemic, because there's just so much popular culture that passes through us on any given day, let alone a week or in a month. And so it's a little bit harder for it to stand out than it had before, but it still does happen. If you think about just a few years ago, a song like All Right by Kendrick Lamar or Formation by Beyonce, typically at a moment when there are social movements going on, those songs then start to have a greater resonance than they would otherwise. The real key to protest music becoming memorable is if there is a movement behind it. It's a kind of symbiotic relationship. The songs are inspired by the movement. The movement is inspired by the songs. The movement might create some of the language or take some of the acts that an artist will then use to write a song. And at the same time, they might be articulating the sentiments of people in the movement that they may not have articulated otherwise for themselves, and they can now sing it in a kind of communal setting. So there is absolutely protest music today. There is lots of protest music today, but it doesn't quite exist in the same kind of cultural.
There is a woman in the vice president's mansion.
That was an interview, a re-listened interview with Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison, looking at the history of protest music in the United States. You can keep sharing your favorites, by the way. Email ideas@WPR.org if there was a protest song that is currently meaningful to you or was at some point in your life. Email us about it, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, should marijuana be legalized? According to a recent poll, the majority of Wisconsin voters say yes. We'll find out how public opinion on marijuana legalization has changed over the last few years and check out what's going on around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.